Okay, well, thank you for coming. I was going to start with a short motivational statement about why a physicist should look at color vision. And I was going to say that we're all physicists here, aren't we? But there are some notable exceptions, I suppose. In any event, it's a very attractive area simply because, certainly for human vision, and at a relatively low level, the problems are fairly well understood. And it's dominated by the physics of the situation. That's not to say that there aren't very substantial and profound problems elsewhere up the pathway, but you can make significant progress by field vision. That's the gloss. And there's also a splendid tradition with Helmholtz, Thomas Young, Maxwell, Schrodinger, and Grassmann, all making significant contributions to study of human and more generally color vision. I should mention my collaborators, Kinjiro Amano from Tokyo, and Sergio Nascimento from MINU. And what I want to concentrate on is something a little bit distal from the eye, that is, what we know about physical scenes. And our ability to identify surfaces within scenes solely on the basis of their color. It's a non-trivial problem because the illumination on scenes changes. So there are three things we have to worry about. Firstly, something about the gamut of colors in natural scenes. Is there a reasonable spread in reflectances to make labeling by color useful? Then there's a biological problem of how color might, surface color might be represented visually. And then in turn, how unique these coatings are.
Color, is it contrast or something else, maybe gradient of contrast? Or?
I'm concerned solely with a biological analog of the reflectance function. There's lots of other things coming in, but I'm concerned at the moment with just reflectance. And if you want to rephrase the question later, okay. I'll concentrate mainly on the theoretical bits and largely avoid the experimental material, since I think most people here are theoreticians. Okay, so if there were just two surfaces of interest, there'd be little problem. But as the number of surfaces increases, things get more complicated, simply because there's a greater chance of two surfaces being chosen at random, having the same or very close reflectance spectra. And it's also, one might anticipate, likely that these neural coatings or more central perceptual coatings are not perfectly invariant under changes in illumination on the scene. And the broad brush, I'm going to largely ignore perceptual and cognitive factors.
Sorry, when you say confusion, confusion doing what?
In using what information we have about surface color as a device for distinguishing between surfaces. Okay? So, this is a Mickey Mouse figure just to make sure that we start out at the same point. This is the sun. It's not a Simpson. And we might suppose it has an illuminant spectrum like that, with lots of energy at long wavelengths. This illuminates a flower, which has a reflectance spectrum. In fact, this actually is the reflectance spectrum of the flower that's caricatured here. The light bounces off with a product of those two, the illuminant times the reflectance spectrum, and it's captured by the eye, and in turn by three classes of cones, short, medium, and long wave sensitive. I guess you know all this. Okay. And the thing to note, by the way, is how close the long and medium wave absorption spectra are. So these signals are captured and give rise to levels of activity in the long, medium, and shortwave cones, and thereafter it's transduced into a different form.
So what we talk about is like, if you want, is it known why it's so close? What's the reason for it to be so close?
Not precisely. In general terms, yes, there are good evolutionary reasons, and you should ask the guy over there about the genetic factors. But the long and medium wave system is a fairly recent addition to the visual system. Much longer ago, many tens of millions of years ago, there were just two pigment systems, and this one diverged 30 million, or was it somewhat less, 30 million or thereabouts years ago, to produce two. And the driving factors for these are the subject of some contention, but it may have been driven by the need to discriminate between certain kinds of fruits and some kinds of leaves, but possibly between fresh leaves and old leaves, because you can do matching studies and you find that these two spectra are pretty well perfectly placed to make those discriminations. But there are others who would argue that they're not.
So is it possible to argue that the precise position of these three different wave detectors and the widths of these sensitivity curves are in some sense optimal under the spectrum of light which we observe in the natural scenes? And I've seen some work done by Joatic a long time ago on this, 15, 20 years ago, on trying to talk about this, but I wasn't that much convinced by that work, so that's why I'm asking.
Originally, when we had one primordial pigment, it was roughly in this region, and it was, well, it was not badly placed in relation to the spectrum of sunlight. It's not really a compelling argument. Okay?
Are there lots of just diachromats out there?
There's only of males, 1 or 2%.
Sorry, I meant animals.
Yeah. I'm sorry, of?
Just different kinds of animals.
Like oh, yes.
Okay. So basically all mammals except us. Primates.
Right? So it would be surprising if it was optimal.
I think cats.
But he has a four, right? Pigeon to somebody like that.
Well, yeah, but turn out a mammal. Lots of vertebrates with the four.
And some mothers who have the misfortune to bear sons that have a certain kind of color deficiency may be tetrachromatic. But it's not known also whether their tetrachromacy, having four rather than three pigments, gives them an advantage, though you might argue that it ought to. It's an aberrant, you should be asking this guy, it's an aberrant pigment. Depending on the kind of color deficiency, one of these pigments may get a small shift inwards. And so the sun that has only the three pigments, one long, one medium, and one short, will have either the long or the medium misplaced. They still make very precise color matches, but they're different from those of a normal subject. But the mother has the advantage of both the normal and the abnormal pigment. So she gets L, M, and a kind of L prime, a slightly modified version, or an M prime, slightly modified, maybe slightly inwards. Just to orient you, this is around 400 nanometers, and this is 700 nanometers, and this is all normalized. Okay. So we've got these three levels of cone activity, S, M, and L, little s, M, and L. And just for the record, it's simply given by straightforward integration of the three functions we're interested in. And the problem is to recover from those LMS signals something about the real world. So we have this triple of cone activities, and we want something like, well, in an ideal, we want the actual reflectance function of the surface we're looking at, the central part of that flower. Well, that's too much, but we actually really want a scaled or altered version of that signal called L0, M0, and S0, which would be the signals the eye would have had looking at this flower under some standard illumination. How can you achieve this? It can be done in a very rough way, very straightforwardly. So we might simply take a spatial average. So we might be concerned with trying to get some measure of the properties of this bit of the leaf here. All we have to do is take an average of activity over a reasonably large portion of the scene. So this might be the signal recorded in long-wave sensitive cones. And then we take an average over the scene, also for long-wave sensitive cones, and divide that by that. The point about this is that if this area is sufficiently large, it should cover most surfaces in the scene. And keeping our fingers crossed, the average surface will be neutral, won't be biased, and that's a gross assumption that can't be justified in practice, but this is the hand wave that goes with it. It does, though, the quotient give you something which is fairly stable under changes in illumination. This is traditionally called the gray world assumption, for obvious reasons. Alternatively, you don't have to be quite so ambitious. You might simply compare the signal in your red sensitive cones with the signal in red sensitive cones from simply another point in the image. Do the same for green sensitive cones and the same for blue sensitive cones. And as is traditional, I'm going to lurch backwards and forwards between saying long, medium, and short, and red, green, and blue sensitive. The latter is an incorrect nomenclature, but it's traditional. So if you take the ratio, in fact, it works very well. So I'll show you shortly how well. Now, these sorts of comparisons depend in practice, if one does experiments on human observers or animal observers. They're affected by the scale of the image. They're affected by things like contrast in the scene and by the gamut of colors within the scene. Even so, those two kinds of pairwise operation, that is, a point-to-point comparison or a point-to-a-large-area comparison, capture the essence of most illuminant invariant operators in this context. But the question, of course, is how invariant. Imagine you've got just two surfaces, one and two, and imagine a little quantum bouncing down, bounces off, and gives rise to a quantum catch, Q1. Same thing happens for surface 2, and gives us a quantum catch, Q2, in, say, red-sensitive receptors. We just take the quotient. Okay. Now do the experiment all over again, same surfaces, but with a different illuminant, E prime. This goes bouncing down, gets caught by long-wave red-sensitive receptors, gives us a quantum catch Q prime 1, and on surface 2, Q prime of 2. Take the ratio again. And the question is, how close is R to R prime? Well, if we plot ratio R against ratio R prime under randomly chosen illuminants, we get a straight line. And this happens to be for shortwave cones, but it's true also for medium and longwave sensitive cones. In this particular simulation, the illuminants were drawn at random from a daylight locus that essentially models of real light from the sky, but it works just as well if you use a Planckian radiator, then you can go over a much wider range, and the stability is still true.
So when you say that the luminance are drawn randomly, does that mean you draw a random E of lambda, or at each wavelength you're picking a random value so that that thing's not smooth?
In fact, it's yes to both, but here it was simply choosing a phase of daylight. So daylight ranges from, say, 4,000 setting sun or lower to maybe 50,000 Kelvin with a clear blue sky. And all I'm doing is sampling anywhere along that continuum of different illuminance from the daylight locus. So just to go back, when I spoke here about E and E prime, these ones that I'm sampling randomly. I've actually just plotted 200 from a set of 1,000, but it's not a sampling issue. You can quantify the errors by simply taking the difference between one ratio and its pair, divided by the minimum. And this almost never goes to zero here. And the mean error, mean relative deviations, about 4% for long, medium, and shortwave sensitive cones, almost identically, providing the images are natural. That is, the surface is sampled from real life. You can do this with, as you hinted, with illuminants that have random reflectance functions. So essentially, they're random step functions. And you can do it with surfaces also that are random functions. Providing they're both not random, you still get very high levels of invariance. But if both the illuminant and the surfaces are random, then it does drop. Relative deviations rise to about 30%, but that really is pathological. One doesn't have random illuminants and random surface reflectance functions. But I don't want you to lose sight of this this error, this 4%, although in biological terms you might say is essentially zero, it turns out to be actually quite important, in fact very important, later on.
Conversely, of course, you can now optimize for illuminations or surfaces that maximize the error data to be very large, and then you can test on human subjects whether or not they have difficulty performing the same.
What would you optimize?
Choose your illumination spectrum, for example, in such a way that you get a large deviation.
In fact, the illumination spectrum is not the problem, as long as it's fairly smooth. The problem is the reflectance functions. So optimization in this case would mean constraining the number of surfaces available to visual organisms. And empirically, that does happen to some extent, if you think of a forest canopy. But that actually contains some of the most unsatisfactory surfaces. So I'm not sure I want to go too far down this route because I want to talk about a different kind of optimization later. But optimization in this case is a less
A little bit ahead. I'm assuming that you're claiming that these ratios actually underlie the coding in the visual system.
Yes, they underlie certainly a large variety of perceptual phenomena, which I'm not going to list here, since it's experimental psychophysics stuff and it could be exquisitely boring to mainstream physicists. But there is a fairly large corpus of data now which does suggest that these ratio signals are a driving force in many kinds of psychophysical experiment. Okay?
Can you explain why the non-smooth reflectance spectrum or reflectance functions of the spectrum would lead to larger errors? How should I understand that?
In fact, there hasn't been a satisfactory anything approaching an analytic proof published, although there has been one attempt, not by me, which got into a terrible mess and wasn't published. The best that's been achieved so far is simply numerical simulation. It is amenable to something more systematic, just no one has ever got the energy to do it. And it's to do basically with taking things out from the integrand and putting them on the outside. And you can do it better when the functions are smooth than when they're non-smooth. Okay. So, given that, and assuming for the moment that we do have invariant codings, how much information could we capture by labeling objects in a scene in this way? Well, if we just look at ratios for a moment, we might just concern ourselves with the relationships between things. So we could represent in some way the scene by a collection of pairs, where we would relate the reflectance here, sorry, the signal in red sensitive cones here and here, or here and here, there to there, and so on. So it's a little bit indirect, but we would have a fairly stable description of the scene as a collection of ratios, and to take away something that would usually be stable under changes in illumination. If, and we were using the grey world assumption, then we would have this red sensitive cone signal here divided by the average in the surround, here, 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 and so on. And again, we would have representation that was fairly stable under changes in illumination. And we might say there were four bits of information contained in those 16 samples. And of course, if there were n samples, then there would be log to the base 2 of n bits. Okay, now let's change the illumination. The question is this information actually preserved? Well, I'm going to just use these ratios because it's easier to see on the figure, not for any philosophical reason. This is under 4,000 Kelvin, so it's direct sunlight going down a little bit. And now let's change it to north skylight, so it seems much bluer now. And how well do these ratios identify the original surfaces? Well, let's just suppose there's five pairs, and let's suppose there's perfect recovery for the moment. So this is just a little Mickey Mouse picture. There's our five ratios. And under the new illumination, let's suppose everything's perfect. We're able to identify from the new signal the old signal unambiguously, in which case, of course, everything is preserved, no information is lost. For an imperfect case, here's the scene under the old illuminant of 4003, and at the new illuminant, we're doing fairly well, so we correctly identify this pair under the new illuminant, correctly identify this pair under the new illuminant, likewise with 4, but under the further attempt, we find that we don't uniquely identify this original pair under new illumination. And the reason is this. And I won't explain it now, but we'll later. Let's assume that we can represent the activities in those L, M, and S receptors in some suitable color space. This happens to be two-dimensional, but it could be three-dimensional. And these are real data for activities in long, medium, and short-wave sensitive cones. So these are the coordinates for one of those surfaces under the first illuminant and that under the second illuminant. That's for the second surface, and that's the third. In each of those three cases, under the new illuminant, it's very clear that the nearest neighbor is the correct old one there, not the number 2, old one there. Likewise for 3, under the new illuminant, there's no doubt this nearest neighbor is to be identified with at that point. But as in the previous Mickey Mouse picture, here, the initial coordinates shift here, and for point 4, surface 4, its coordinates shift there. And so, under the new illuminant, the surface 5 is misidentified with 4 rather than with 5 as it should be. So generally there is a loss of information. But of course, that's hand-waving, and we need to quantify this using estimates of the probabilities of making those errors. And this is just the usual formula describing the transition matrix. So if Pij is the probability of identifying point J under illuminant E2 with point I or surface I under illuminant E1, then the mutual information is given by this expression. I guess everybody's familiar with, painfully familiar with this. And Pi and Pj are the marginal probabilities. And all we have to do is to evaluate this for all the surfaces in the scene under different illuminations.
You'll have to do something with your samples on these quantities when the usual information is known to be extremely rough to estimate from samples. And you will really have to sample unbelievably many pictures to do that.
Yes, which is the point of my next slide or two. Yep.
So it seems like I could think of an example where there's a one-to-one mapping between the I's and the J's, but it scrambles everything up. So it would have maximal mutual information because how do you sort of...
It doesn't happen like... Well, it doesn't happen like that. If it was reliably simply a transposition, then nothing is lost. It's simply a relabeling. But it's not. I hope I can show you soon. But you're entirely right about the problems of numerical evaluation. You can go so far, but not very far. So the things I want to explore are how the mutual information might vary with the nature of the scene, how it might vary with the kinds of coding. I've only given you two examples here, and there's lots of others. But for this, we actually need real reflectance data from real scenes. So here's the chance to do some experimental physics. We use a hyperspectral imaging technique, which is a method of taking images from scenes which are sliced through the spectrum. And this is just a montage of of a scene taken at 10 nanometer intervals, ranging from 400 to 720 nanometers. So I should put up a picture. The device is like an ordinary, slightly upmarket digital camera, but it's only got one kind of sensor. It's monochromatic. Stuck on the front is a fast liquid crystal filter that's controlled electronically. And this slices through the spectrum from 400 to 720 with a bandwidth of about 10 nanometers. If you're very lucky, in just a few seconds. If it's not a very good one, then it may take several tens of seconds. It's only recently become possible to obtain devices with a normal budget, I guess, of, well, below $80,000, to obtain a device which you can actually use in practice in the field. And what this gives you is a way of recording information about real scenes which largely bypass the problems of temporal variation. No matter how quiet a real scene might be with no wind, there is always some activity in recording these kinds of data. They're just very small thermal currents, and then there are gross events like people getting in the way or animals or leaves falling and so on. So it's a fairly physically intensive experience with a large number of rejects because of small movements taking place. But if you choose your location and time sufficiently carefully, you can get good data. And this particular system has a special resolution that's very similar to that of the human eye, about a minute of arc by a minute of arc visual angle. And the angle is sub-tense, the field size is about 7 degrees visual angle. And these were recorded in a very pleasant part of, maybe not quite as pleasant, Santa Barbara, but still a very pleasant part of the world, in northern Portugal, in the Minho region, which actually has a very useful range of natural variation in vegetation, rocks, forests, scrub, fairly open fields. And it turns out Curic, by coincidence, to have been an important route in the migration of early hominids from North Africa through to Europe. That's by the by. So these data I'm going to show you were recorded during the summers of, well, last year and the year before. Almost always under a clear sky or under a leafy canopy. I've already mentioned movement. We're very careful to avoid it. In fact, in these kinds of acquisition, we usually have a number of spotters. So there's one guy staring through the camera, making sure everything's in focus. Then there's four or five others scattered around the scene, out of shot, keeping an eye locally on small movements. And so people put their hands up, and then they go down. We have to report and start all over again. So in one day, we can get probably two, maybe three good scenes. That's starting at around, by the time we get to the location site, I guess around about 10 in the morning, and finishing perhaps around 3 or 4 in the afternoon before the sun goes down too far. And these are just some close-ups. These little spheres here are about the size of a pea, and they're coated with a standard uniform grey paint, taken from a thing called the Munsell set. This is a Munsell grey N5. And these little peas on pins are stuck in the scene to record information about the illumination on it and about its directionality as well as its spectral content. These happen to be chrysanthemums, but that's incidental. And this is a variety of lily, I think. And the sphere is stuck down here. These are actually very close up, but in contrast, well, first let me show you. It just means that at each point now, we can actually say this is the reflectance spectrum at that point on the flower. Likewise, just there, some roses. And these are the reflectance spectra at those, as you might expect, there's lots of reflectance in the red end of the spectrum, which is all very reassuring. And yellow behaves sensibly too. So I'll just run through the family photos. These are some of the scenes you've seen already. There's a long shot of some cultivated fields in a region called Brufa. And this sphere now is the size of about 1.5 footballs. It's a glass sphere, again coated with this gray paint. It looks as if it's hovering, but it's actually stuck on three tripods. The problem is, of course, we'd ideally like to place this sphere in the middle of the scene, but that's actually several kilometers away, so it's not that easy. So when recording these kinds of scenes, it really is essential to have an absolutely clear sky. And there was for this. Town picture, Braga. Part of a forest scene. And you can actually just see the edge of a standard reference here, gray surface there. Likewise, another part of a forest scene. And that's just crept in the left here, again for reference. And there's just some plant there. This is, does anybody here speak Portuguese? Now, this is a monastery. It's a monastery garden. It was recorded for aesthetic reasons, not for its scientific content. But it gives an interesting spread in surfaces. These are a collection of buildings on a river in the center of Porto, in the port making area of Portugal. It's important to try and avoid water and glass. Water we avoided, but there is actually the occasional reflection from surfaces here, which we eventually, later when we do analyses, have to cut out.
Why is it important to do that?
Because glass isn't a normal surface. In this context, it's not opaque. And physically gives rise to highlights, which it technically says it's a problem because then it gives rise to saturation in the camera. But from the point of view of the design of the experiments, we want to have indirect information about the illuminant from the surfaces in the scene. If we have a perfectly reflecting surface in the scene, when I say in our experiments, I mean subsequently when we do psychophysical experiments or analyses. If we have a perfectly reflecting surface like a mirror or a piece of glass, then we have perfect information about the illuminant. And that's precisely what we're trying to avoid. We're trying to measure the limits on inference from surfaces in the absence of direct knowledge about the illumination. Farmhouse, more forestry. It was familiar, actually. So anyway, for this kind of scene, or indeed for any of them, we can get so far with numerical simulation. So if we plot our estimate of mutual information against number of sample surfaces for a town. So along here, I've got I, mutual information. Along here, I've got log to the base 2 of the number of surfaces being sampled for buildings, leaves, and fields.
What is the number of surfaces being sampled? It's just number of points?
Yes.
Number of
points. Yep. And reasonably, if you only sample a very small number, like 2, then there's no problem. You never lose anything. Well, almost. At this point, you need to make, we were making 2 to the 18 or 2 to the 20 iterations to get these numerical estimates. At that point, we had sufficiently many samples that we could make reliable estimates of those p-values, but much beyond 10 here, the data become unreliable, and that's known in the literature. So it looks as if performance is increasing monotonically, and it looks as if it's similar for the 4 types of scenes, and it looks as if they're all tending towards an asymptote. But there are problems with estimating these values of p with large values of n. Fortunately, when n is so large that we can consider the distribution of surfaces as being continuous, we can approximate the whole problem as simply an additive Gaussian channel. So let's suppose for a moment that each point here is coded as a triple, and they're scaled triples, scaled by the surrounding. So each point in the scene is represented by an LMS scaled pattern of activity in our photoreceptors under illuminant E1. And under illuminant E2, we suppose the coding isn't perfectly invariant. There's a small error of delta L in L1, delta M in M1, and delta S in S1. So these are simply L2, M2, and S2. And if K1 is the covariance of the original signal, and K delta is the covariance of these small errors, then the limiting value, the maximum value of the mutual information is the capacity, which is simply the quotient of these two, of their determinants, is log to the base 2. This is nothing more really than log to the base 2 of signal plus noise over noise. We're happy with that. Okay. So there are some assumptions in here. In particular, that we can represent the system as an additive Gaussian channel. If this noise is not Gaussian, then it turns out that this still represents the maximum mutual information available if the matching process is one of nearest neighbor. Remember before when I showed that little picture of the mislocated, I won't go back, of the mislocated points in that color space. Although we can argue about the metric, the matching operation is a nearest neighbor operation. So, what kinds of numbers do we get? And these are averages over 25 scenes, rural and urban. And for an illuminant change of 25,000 to 6,500 Kelvin, this is a kind of a standard daylight to a very blue sky, the mean information capacity is just over 11 bits using the gray world coding, and using ratios only slightly lower. Going the other direction from a close to setting sun, or a little bit warmer, a little bit cooler, 4,000 Kelvin up to daylight, the capacity is again just under 12 bits, and fairly similar for ratio coding.
I guess both of this encoding depends on the radius of the gray patch and the distance between the points of emission in the equations.
It doesn't depend on the size of the area, because the ratio case is a limit, in essence, of this case, where the diameter of the average area tends to zero, but then is displaced. Does that make sense? And as far as the separation in this case of the ratio is concerned, providing you go beyond, well, in this context, a few pixels, the point spread function for the cameras about 1.5 pixels. Providing you go beyond about 2 pixels or so, maybe 3 pixels, then these ratios don't depend very much on the spacing between the two. However, the point I wanted to emphasize is that the standard deviation on these estimates, these are not standard errors, but standard deviations, are remarkably small, which is the long-winded way of saying these averages are an accurate representation of how much information is preserved in almost any old scene you choose, providing it's reasonably complicated, which is what I just said down here. Despite the variety, the information capacity limiting, the physical information capacity limiting visual performance is remarkably stable. And it suggests that performance in using color information to label things might be optimized independent of location. That is, given a reasonably rich environment, you get as much information, you are limited as much in that direction as in that direction. So whatever resources you might have available, it's worthwhile pitching them at that level of capacity. Because you know in practice, no matter where you look, it's going to be roughly that demanding or that limiting. No argument. Okay. So implications. It appears from simply looking at the physics of the situation that there's a fundamental limit on the use of labeling. It's nothing to do with limits on neuronal or cognitive function. At the lowest level possible, we can't do perfectly in labeling. The next step actually is to find out whether human beings work up to this limit or not. And we can make an estimate of human limits by measuring their matching performance of scenes under different illuminations. And we can predict how well they ought to perform by making use of the same assumptions that went into making these calculations. That is, by trying to find theoretical matches that minimize the variance in the assumed representation of the scene. So this is the experimental task.
So the thing that you should want to compare with respect to is that we can only get 11 bits of color information from a big image.
No. The factors which set that limit in a big image are to do with the variance in the new values of the codes you get, code values you get under the new illuminant. That is, they're limited by, if you like, the noise attached that's associated with those codings under a change in illumination. And for any particular surface, it will fail to meet the expected value by that small amount of noise error. And what I want to do it'll turn out to be a fairly complicated scene anyway, but measure performance for a particular surface in the context of that scene. So maybe the answer to your question is yes. In the context of that scene is I want to measure how well we work up against that limit, that physical limit of that small noise error.
This limit is strongly dependent on, I guess, the assumption that the humans use these particular types of coding. That is a ratio coding, or the gray level coding, whatever.
Yes.
Is there anything else that you could
Yes. use? There are many other kinds of illuminant or approximately illuminant invariant coding that have been proposed, not just in the psychophysical and cognitive literature, and which appeal there to higher level concepts to do with the nature of things, the identity of things, naming and so on, expectations concerning the color of bananas and so on. There's a quite separate area of activity there, but at the machine vision end, there are several broad classes of theory that go well beyond these very elementary descriptions. Work in that area, though, has been dominated by the wish there to actually make a good estimate of the illuminant, whereas the aim here is a bit more modest. It's not to estimate the illuminant, it's to see how well you can say whether this surface is the same as that surface under a different light, without actually saying what the different light is. In other words, it's can you get by in this environment, not necessarily can you estimate what color light was on the scene. And that's why these simpler codings work. And as I indicated earlier, there is a body of psychophysical evidence now which suggests, or which we know actually underpins, which these codings underpin, the idea of scaling by area is in the trade called von Kreis scaling. And it has certainly some failings, but as a broad description of visual performance, it's not so bad. And ratio coding also seems to describe a variety of other kinds of surface color judgment phenomena. In these experiments, it's been usual to use, in fact, since 1986, it's been compulsory to use computer-controlled monitors on which appear geometric displays like Mondrian patterns, colors of different patches of surfaces and so on, under different lights, and subjects have to make judgments of the color of this patch against that patch. And more recently, similar sorts of experiments have been performed using computer-controlled displays, using simulations of natural scenes, that is, using the hyperspectral data I just described to simulate on a TV monitor the real scene. And then you manipulate the illumination on the scene and get people to make matches. But in both cases, there's a gamut problem. So it's a small diversion into color spaces to make the point that I want to make. We have to use a chromaticity diagram. And for that, in turn, we need something called tri-stimulus values. It isn't really quite so bad. All that we do is we convert a given spectrum by taking its product with three standard color matching functions. In rough terms, you can think of these as being a bit like red, green, and blue sensitive spectral sensitivities, except they're not. They're something more general because they offer certain technical advantages in doing these manipulations. And they've become standard since the 1930s, 1931. And these pseudo spectra are these here. So this is a sort of red, a sort of green, and a sort of blue, but they don't look a lot like the real thing. And we just take a slightly normalized version. We divide the x-coordinate by the sum and the y-coordinate by the sum, of course, z-coordinate's just the difference from 1. And these x and y are the so-called chromaticity coordinates you get on some kinds of color photometer. You can point at scenes, it'll give you coordinates in terms of x and y, chromaticity coordinates. And white is 0.3, 0.3. So the point about this is to show you how bad monitors can be. This is an XY chromaticity diagram. So that's red, that's green, sort of, and that's sort of blue. This horseshoe-shaped thing is the spectrum, sorry, is the boundary of all the colors that we can perceive. And this actual boundary is the so-called spectrum locus, giving all the colors of monochromatic light. Now, white is just here, and this triangle is the range of colors that we can show on a color monitor. There are actually six here. Three are for traditional color monitors, and three are for TFT type devices. They're very, very similar. And that thing's just to orient you, and this is the daylight locus here. So the sad thing is the computer monitors can't display the full gamut of colors that we would get from real physical objects. So instead, yeah.
So I guess I don't see why that is going to be critically important, because I mean, there's still a fair number of color, right? You can rephrase the problem completely in terms of something with the color that you can generate with the color molecule, right? And you still.
Yes, but not as well.
So are you saying that a solution that you, if you just totally did this with computer generated colors, the solution you came up with may not generalize to
It wouldn't be such a strong test. For most natural surfaces, particularly on a hazy day, there'd be no problem in locating them entirely within the gamut of a monitor. I'm just looking around for a real example, but I can't. Perhaps, no. I was looking for a strong green, but there aren't any in this room. However, there's a very large area of greeny, bluey things that aren't represented well on monitors and which probably are important in real life. And we have actually done the experiments inside those constraints, and the results are good enough, but they're not as, it's not a stronger test, because it turns out that the noise is largest in those color potential color matching operations for surfaces that give reflected light, which is close to the spectrum locus, that's outside the normal gamut of a monitor. So in these experiments that Vashgupta Dal made and his other colleagues were doing with us, they set up a real physical display. So this is still not very natural, at least it's physical. And it's a series of steps on which there are platonic solids covered with, actually I'm not sure that is a platonic solid, covered with different kinds of standard colored paper. And on the left side, the illumination was, I think, 25,000. On the right side, it's 4,000 Kelvin, so blue and yellow light. And it was part of a large optical setup in which this object here wasn't really there. It was a virtual image of another cube somewhere else that had its own private illumination from a digital projector. This happens to be shown gray here, but we can get any color we like. And we can replace its reflecting surface by anything we like to get that larger gamut of colors. And all the subject has to do, using electronic control, is to adjust the apparent color on the right side here until it matches the color of the surface on the left side. It's important to emphasize that that matching operation is not one about lights reaching the eye, because you can see clearly that under these blue and yellow lights, this looks bluish and this looks more reddish. But it's still possible to say that this surface is the same as that surface. I'm not asking you to do that in this context because you've got all the other things around. It's not a very good display. But we make these judgments all the time. So if you look at this grey-greenish surface here, some of you can see the shadowed side on this side. I guess you can't over here. But despite the fact that the shadowed side here, you can see, is darker than the illuminated side here, you can still quite reliably make the judgment that this material here is the same as that material here, and that you know the difference in color here is not due to a change in the fabric, but simply due to a change in the illumination. Here it's directish light, here it's much less direct, scattered from elsewhere in the room. And people can make these judgments, and they do it very reliably. They sometimes make these experiments side by side, sometimes you can do it sequentially, matching, if you like, the change in the way that the cloud might pass over the sun, and things go from being yellowish to grey-bluish. To measure the goodness of people's matches, we have to jump into another color space, which I won't explain, but a bit like the previous ones, but now it takes into account the fact that we really want to represent people's judgments of surface color, not of colored lights. So in this space, this is the position of a surface under the first illuminant. That's its position in this space under a second illuminant, and that's the distance between the two with regard to some suitable metric. And that's the observer's guess, or considered judgment, about where this second surface should be. Now, it should be there, but the observer's not perfect and has placed the point there, and the error is size b. We just take the quotient, b over a, take it away from 1, and this gives us probably the most commonly used index of performance in this literature. So if they're perfect, the index is unity. But if they're very, very imperfect, it can actually go negative. But usually it doesn't. In fact, usually it ranges between 0 and 1, and more commonly between 0.2 and about 0.6 or 0.7, depending on instructions. The problem with this device, though, is that it's insensitive to angle. The constancy index there is the same there as it is there. So we have to record the angular error as well as the magnitude of the error, which is what we did. And these are the summary data. So these are the magnitudes of the errors. The bluish lilac colored columns are the predicted limiting constancy index values, and the more magenta purpley reddish ones are the observers' matched values. These are averages over a large number of trials. And down here is the color of the cube that's being set up as a test object. That is its this thing here. And so that's the observer's attempt. As for angular errors, these are degrees here. Again, this is the predicted performance, and that's the observed performance. And again, just to emphasize, the rule is to find constancy indices of the order of perhaps 0.6, sometimes 0.7 if they're fairly good. These are actually exceptionally high, but not here. And significantly also, the predicted level of performance has gone down. These angular errors in matching performance are systematic, and they show a small tendency by observers not to make a surface color match, but to make a simple light color match, a hue saturation brightness match. That is, they, in inverted commas, forget about the task and concentrate on simply making the color of the light on the two sides the same, which would be perfect in constancy. And there's a small tendency towards that, and that's why all these predicted values are a little bit less. The most notable error is in this area here. The point to take home is, though, these predicted values contain no free parameters. On the basis of simply minimizing the a match so that, sorry, selecting a match so the variance is minimized, we're left with nothing else. Now, these differences certainly are reliable, so I'm not suggesting, in fact, that the concurrence is perfect, but the trend is certainly encouraging. So to summarize,
I guess I don't understand in this context what would be a good fit and what would be sort of the measurement here. For example, the yellow, it looks as though the observer is actually doing better than
yes.
predicted. So somehow, how many bits does that correspond to?
I certainly can't tell you how many bits that correspond. In fact, it may not even make sense in this context. The difference is very close to reliable, but not quite. So the standard deviation, not standard error, standard deviation on these sorts of measurements tends to be about 0.05, maybe 0.07. So these differences probably are reliable. This is probably not. Overall, the model is not an adequate representation of the data, but we didn't expect it to be so. All we really wanted to find out is, roughly speaking, do variations in the predicted performance reliably anticipate those in observed performance, which is more or less true. They stay high, it goes low, it goes high. And they go roughly in the right sorts of directions here with orientation, with their angular error. The other thing we were concerned about is predicted performance of the same order as observed performance, or is observed performance a lot less, typically 0.1, 0.2, or 0.3, poorer than what we believe is limited, is limiting visual performance.
Okay. How can we factor performance being better than reading? What does it mean?
Well, observers are able to make use of other kinds of information in the scene, and they're also able to make use of experience. And I'm not sure I want to press this, but you could argue that their previous experience with green surfaces that led them to anticipate in particular these kinds of problems, and so they tend to compensate. But as I said, I'm not sure I want to make too much. These differences probably are significant, but I think given the general level of reliability of these kinds of measurements, it's not so bad. In general, so performance doing better, worse, worse, better, better. Well, on a sign test, it isn't compelling, but here, I think there is a good case to be made for a really systematic difference, and we understand the nature of the difference, this bias towards the old illuminant. If you wanted to improve...
To go back to the left-hand curve, if the underlying argument is that the visual system has a representation of a certain number of bits worth of information, then if that limits performance to a certain level, then it is not possible, experience or otherwise, because the information just isn't there. You should get random, if it's a really large number of trials, you should get randomly better or worse, and they should average to something that's more than one. So it seems to me the fact you find any of these that go beyond the limit says that there is actually more information.
I guess there are two answers. I hope I remember them. The first one is that the calculation on the number of bits was contingent on those two particular models of extracting invariant representations.
Well, maybe that's what's wrong.
It is. There, for example, well, and one would normally use not the original absorption spectra for long, medium, and short wave cones. One would use a sharpened version of long and medium wave sensitive cones. So here's short, medium, and long. And very short, very soon after the first initial phototransduction, these are turned into an opponent signal. And from some kinds of psychophysical data, this is not opponent color, but cone opponent. You get a sharpened version of this thing, which looks more like that, possibly with a small shoulder. And likewise, this thing shifts rightwards and has maybe a slight shoulder on the left. The point is, though, you get a separation of these two long and medium wave absorption spectra, a functional separation.
Isn't that as a result of processing in the visual system?
Well, you can get, it happens very, very early. You get opponency is almost impossible not to find in the visual system. But it happens immediately after cone phototransduction. The point about this...
So you should have used those spectra.
Yes, I should have. Well, I have. I did. I was trying. Okay, I can show you afterwards that if you do, then you get between 1 and 1.5 bits improvement in the maximum. You also get an improvement in predicted matching performance. But I want to keep the story fairly simple. And there was a second. The second point was, even if you set all that on one side, this is a sampling problem. That is, when people make matches, they make a setting, and that act of making a setting itself has some uncertainty attached to it.
Okay, but that comes back to the first objection that I don't understand what the error bars in a sense are on those two points. I mean, that's some result of doing either systematic issues like I don't know how the guy is pushing the button, and then also just sampling over a sufficient number of trials. But and that comes back to the question: is are these differences significant or not? And that's something that has to be measured, obviously, in a specific experiment.
And I think, as I said earlier, these differences are almost certainly significant. I did say that this model does not account for the variance, or something equivalent to the variance in the data. So in a formal sense, the model fails. But that wasn't the point. Given that it has no free parameters, all I really wanted to do was to establish whether it describes in a very broad way the pattern of variation in observed performance, that is, whether it's high, low, whether it broadly follows the angular dependence here. Okay, this is not physics. The aim here is simply to see whether this kind of broad brush description can account for the qualitative behavior of human matching performance. If you want a more comprehensive a model that will account much more tightly for the observed data, then you have to introduce some additional parameters. You'd have to, well, as a first step, make a more realistic model of the initial coding. You then have to make some reasonable judgment about what the optimum invariant coding would be for observers and do some reasonable sampling of those kinds of models.
That's a different kind of question you could ask, is if you chose, you know, there's some number of choices of invariant codings, and for the different invariant choices of these invariant codings, what are your predictions for this particular experiment? Then you get in a sense a feel of how incisive this experiment is in actually distinguishing different models. I mean, if you get roughly the same behavior, more or less independent of the choice of invariant coding, clearly, this experiment is not doing very much to really tell you what kind of code it is.
But that isn't the object. The object is not to determine the type of coding. The object is to find out whether human performance is broadly at the level set by the physical limitations on the stimuli. And I remember now the second point, and that was, these predictions are based on minimizing the variance in the assumed representation, these simple ratios or local averages, and doesn't depend directly on any calculations to do with information theory, although the information theory calculations depend upon those minimum variance assumptions. So with regard to testing models, one is actually looking at this minimum variance assumption more than anything else. So, for the two kinds of coding, that is pairwise ratio coding and von Kreis area coding, information capacity is fairly stable over scenes. In fact, remarkably, the variance is very small, less than one bit. And that's also true for these. That is, the capacity goes up, but the variance is still less than about a bit. They point to a physical limit on observers' surface color matching judgments. And in contrast to a variety of, in fact, I think almost all previous models of surface color matching, there are no free parameters. But the qualitative behavior of observers' performance is reasonably well reproduced. At that point, I'll stop. Thank you.